From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Journalist Stanley Karnow is best known for his bestseller, Vietnam, A History, and for the companion public television series, which he also wrote. His new book looks at America as a colonial power. Coming up, Karnow talks about America's empire in the Philippines. Also in the second of a two-part interview, Steve Reich talks about his new recorded composition called Electric Counterpoint. He wrote it for jazz guitarist Pat Metheny. And we have reviews of a new album by composer and tenor saxophonist David Murray and the new TV series, The Robert Guillaume Show. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Stanley Karnow describes his new book as the story of America's only major colonial experience, the story of why Americans colonized the Philippines, what they did there, and what has been the legacy of their rule. The downfall of Ferdinand Marcos and the election of Corazon Aquino have heightened American awareness of these islands on the Pacific Rim. Karnow wants to extend our understanding to the less familiar history that puts the recent drama in context. Stanley Karnow first covered the Philippines 30 years ago as the chief Asia correspondent for Time magazine. He later reported on Asia for the Saturday Evening Post, the London Observer, and NBC News. But perhaps his most memorable contribution to our understanding of that region is the public TV series which he wrote, Vietnam, A Television History, and his companion book, which was a bestseller. His new book is called In Our Image, America's Empire in the Philippines. I asked Stanley Karnow if the Philippines seemed like a logical subject to explore after Vietnam.
Well, I did think that it was logical, if you can use that word, to go from an area where the United States had been very deeply involved, that is Vietnam, to an area where the United States, in a way, had been even more deeply involved historically, which is the Philippines. That is, the Philippines had been an American colony from 1899, 1898 to 1946. We'd spent a lot more time there, obviously, than we did in Vietnam. And perhaps it seemed to me, I'm not sure that I actually sat down and charted this and planned it, but what I've been trying to do is to tell these stories about America abroad, not about necessarily the countries themselves. In other words, this is the book on my latest book, In Our Image, is really a book about America in a foreign climate, in a foreign country, and not a history of the Philippines. I mean, that's for the Filipinos to do. You know how often it is that you go abroad and discover yourself, and that's, in a sense, what the book is about.
Before we get into the story of the United States involvement in the Philippines, let me ask you a question about your research on the Philippines. Did you start your research on this book before or after Corazon Aquino took over the Philippines?
I started the research on the book in late 1983, early 1984, before she took over as president. I started to think about the book and the television series that goes with it soon after her husband, Benigno Aquino, was assassinated, which was in August of 1983.
And he had been a friend of yours?
He'd been a friend of mine. I say that I kind of broke the rules for a journalist to befriend a politician. But he was a fascinating guy, and we did become friends. And it occurred to me after he was assassinated that this was going to be a major story. I had no idea how it was going to develop. And the least of all, the idea that his wife would become president of the Philippines.
There must have been some frustrating times for you when you were looking at what was happening in 1898, and in the meantime, all this new stuff was happening on the Philippines. You know, Marcos was leaving the island, and Cory was taking over. Do you know what I mean? It must have been hard for you to decide when to look at the present and when to look at the past.
Well, it's true. I was doing looking at the two things at the same time, but I really did feel that I was not going to write a book, like many of the other books that have come out, about this immediate period.
Mm-hmm.
The immediate period, let's say for the last 5 or 6 years, those years were of great interest to me. but I wanted to put them in a perspective that went back to the turn of the century. So I tried hard not to be deflected and tried hard not to be diverted by the current events. it wasn't easy. I mean, Cory Aquino, for example, would say to me, well, aren't you coming out to the polls to do this? Or I'm giving a speech this afternoon, you ought to come in. And I had to say, well, I'll try and turn up for it if I can. But I really would much prefer to spend my time in the library doing some research, because I could always listen to her speech on the radio or see it on television. And I really, when I got down to doing the book, as you can see from the size of it, that I had to put this present period in the perspective of the past 90 years.
Well, let's talk about the history of America's involvement in the Philippines. First of all, you say that compared to Europe, the U.S. was benign and sentimental as imperialists. Did we handle the Philippines differently than, say, the Europeans handled their colonies?
I think in general we were less exploitive, and that was because it wasn't necessary for the United States to go abroad for markets or raw materials. Most of that was in the United States itself. I mean, the wealth of America was greater than anything we needed abroad. So we went abroad with a certain kind of missionary zeal, so to speak, and we were determined to turn the Filipinos into facsimile Americans. From the very beginning, we set up a judicial system. We held elections. One of the most important things we did was to bring in school teachers as early as 1901. About 1,000 school teachers who fanned out around the islands, opened schools under miserable conditions to teach the Filipinos English, so that English has become almost the common language of the Philippines. Now, if you compare that to other colonial experiences, the French really exploited places like Vietnam. Whole provinces were turned into rubber plantations or rice fields owned by French companies. The British did the same in India. The Dutch did the same in Indonesia. It's interesting that Congress, very early on in this century, passed a law forbidding Americans to own more than about 1,000 acres of land in the Philippines. I think this was, relative to the European colonialism, I do think it was benign, progressive. Now, there's another way of looking at it, which is, in terms of our own aims, was it successful? And there I think we find that it falls down. We thought we were going to establish democracy in the Philippines, and we did bring in democratic institutions. But they became distorted and warped because they didn't fit Filipino values. Filipinos relate to each other very personally. The key to the society is the family, the ritual kin, the village, the town, and lastly, the nation, lastly, the entity. And, you know, we believe, or at least ideally, in impersonal institutions. Everybody is equal before the law. And so here are two societies that the American society colliding with the Philippine society. And I think two societies are totally dissimilar, totally different in their outlooks.
Why did the United States enter the Spanish-American War in 1898? What were our motives?
The United States at the end of the closing decades of the 19th century was booming economically, and it was industrializing very quickly. We had waves of immigrants coming to the United States, adding to the labor force. It was a tremendously dynamic period in American history. And there was one faction in the United States, in Washington, the imperialist faction, composed of people like Theodore Roosevelt, Senator Lodge of Massachusetts, and others, who felt that we had to project this enormous industrial power abroad, that we had to go forth and become a world power. There was another faction consisting of people like Mark Twain and Andrew Carnegie, the steel tycoon, who said, no, that's not the thing to do. The thing to do is stay at home, We have no business going and projecting our power abroad. There was a very sharp debate over what to do. And suddenly, you had this rebellion in Cuba. The Cubans are rebelling against Spanish rule. And the Cuban lobby in the United States, there was a Cuban propaganda machine in the United States, which was very, very effective. Supported by American interests, sugar interests, that had plantations in Cuba. And through a series of accidents, and history is so often a series of accidents, we went to war with Cuba, with Spain over Cuba. The president of the United States at the time, William McKinley, was a conspicuously indecisive man who couldn't make up his mind, and he kind of got railroaded into the war. The Philippines was a Spanish possession, and Theodore Roosevelt, who was an assistant, young assistant secretary of the Navy, secretly ordered Commodore Dewey, who had a small squadron in Asia, to attack the Spanish fleet. And Dewey did. He sank the Spanish fleet in 7 hours on May 1st, 1898, soon after the Spanish surrendered. And then everyone said, well, what are we going to do with these islands? McKinley couldn't even locate them on the map. And so after much debate, McKinley decided to annex, to keep the Philippines. And there we were. We got involved. And again, it's so typical history, in my estimation, that things that start out, events that start out accidentally, start out as expedients, start out as diversions, as this was, suddenly become dogmas, and we find ourselves stuck in this place, committed to this place, and so we have to begin to justify it. And the justification became one of, we will go in there and we will convert these people to our way of life. The first civilian governor, American civilian governor of the Philippines, William Howard Taft, referred to the Filipinos as our little brown brothers. It was a really condescending phrase, but deep down, I think he really thought that he was doing God's work out there.
So the mission was supposed to be modernize and Americanize. But you say that one of the big mistakes that United States made in the Philippines was that we coddled the elite and we ignored the problems of peasants.
The kind of people that represented the Filipino elite were the kind of people that our own officials are comfortable with. William Howard Taft, who was a Republican from Ohio, was comfortable with an upper-class Filipino. In that respect, many of these upper-class Filipinos were extraordinarily well-educated. And so American policy, colonial policy and practice for the first 10, 12 years was to work through this upper class. And in doing so, we were not going to ruffle an upper class which based its power and wealth in a feudal land system. And so there was very little reformism in American foreign policy or colonial policy. But I might add that there was very little reformism in American policy at home either until you get to the New Deal in the 1930s of the Franklin Roosevelt administration.
Let me ask you about what you were just saying. You said that we coddled the elite, we ignored the problems of peasants. American officials felt more comfortable with the Philippine elite. Did this pave the way, do you think, for the abuses of Marcos? I mean, was the American attitude in part responsible for the corruption that ended up in the highest offices in the Philippines?
Well, it's a big jump from our policy in, let's say, 1910 or 1920 to the Marcos period. But let me put it this way, that at the end of the American colonial period in 1946, there was an entrenched oligarchy, an entrenched group of families, and there is to this day. Now, Marcos came along, and in a sense, you could argue that Marcos really tried to destroy the old oligarchy. The problem with Marcos was, once having destroyed it, he replaced it with his own cronies, so that his own cronies and turned out to be worse than the old entrenched oligarchy. Part of it was that they were hungrier for money and lusted after wealth and were much more corrupt than anything we'd seen before. Marcos is overthrown. Mrs. Aquino comes in, calling her takeover of power a revolution. In fact, it's a restoration because the old families are back again. Now, to blame it on the United States is, in my estimation, you know, partly true. We didn't do anything to destroy those old landed families going back to the turn of the century. But also, the Filipinos themselves didn't do anything to undermine those old families. So that you can't pin it all on the United States. I mean, I think it's always a kind of what I would call a sort of liberal racism to blame the United States for all the problems of other countries. I mean, the Filipinos are people. If one respects them as individuals, then one has to believe that they themselves ought to be doing things. They themselves ought to be reforming their society. We can't go around blaming the United States for everything that's wrong in these countries.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk with you more about your research into the Philippines, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is journalist Stanley Carnow. We're talking about his new book, In Our Image, America's Empire in the Philippines. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is journalist Stanley Carnow. He's reported for Time and Life, The Washington Post, and NBC News. He wrote the book and the TV series Vietnam, A History. His new book, In Our Image, America's Empire in the Philippines, is the story of America's only major colonial experience. As you point out in the book, after World War II, many nationalistic movements were initiated, movements trying to throw off colonial rule. But only in the Philippines did that transition occur peacefully. This was ironically applauded by Ho Chi Minh, who later ended up not applauding America's actions. Why did this occur peacefully? Why did the United States give independence to the Philippines right after World War II, 1946?
Mind you, I want to point out that consistent with what I call relative benevolence, Congress in 1916 had voted the Jones Act, named for a Virginia congressman, to give eventual independence to the Philippines. And this is quite extraordinary for a colonial power. I mean, the French, the British, the Dutch, and the others never even contemplated the idea of giving independence to their colonies. So there was, in this American, in this mix, an American desire really to guide the Philippines, tutor the Philippines toward self-government. So in 1946, it was logical, finally, to declare or to give the Philippines their independence.
So the United States gave independence to the Philippines in 1946. But you point out that, ironically, Americans had greater privileges after we gave independence to the Philippines.
Yes, we compelled the Philippines to amend their constitution, their 1935 constitution, to permit Americans to have equal rights in the exploitation of natural resources. And all that was were the strings that were attached to our giving aid for the rehabilitation of the Philippines after the Second World War. I mean, every country acts in self-interest, and that was in America's self-interest at that stage, or at least in the interests of the groups that were lobbying for those rights, the American groups.
Although most of your book focuses on the history of the Philippines, and as you pointed out earlier, while all this upheaval was happening in the Philippines, you were frequently in the library. I know that you nevertheless did a lot of research into what happened in the last few years in the Philippines. Do you feel like you dug up anything that was new, that was unknown before, about the way the United States government handled Marcos and Aquino during Marcos's final days and Aquino's transition into power?
Well, I think I have the only account in the book of the really the final moments and the moments that preceded that, in which the group in the State Department, plus some people in the Pentagon, notably the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral William Crowe, really exerted pressure on President Reagan to discard Marcos, whom Reagan had considered to be an old friend. And I have almost, and I think this is unique, if I could sound immodest about it, almost the minute-by-minute play of that final day on February 23rd, 1986, the meetings that took place at Secretary of State Shultz's house in Bethesda, the meeting that took place in the White House afterward. I was very fortunate to be able to get notes of those meetings, almost a transcript of those meetings, and recreate exactly what happened.
What do you think Aquino's chances are now of fixing the economy, of getting more equity in the country, of undoing some of the damage that's been done?
Cory Aquino inherited not only 20 years of Marcos and all the corruption and plunder, to which to this day we can't even estimate, but she also inherited centuries of social disparities between rich and poor, rigidities. She inherited, although the Catholic Church in the Philippines is very liberal in many respects, it is very rigid on the issue of family planning and birth control, and that's one of the key problems in the Philippines. You have imagine in my own lifetime, when I went to the Philippines in the 50s, the population was something like 20 million. Today it's 60 million. I mean, before one's very eyes, you can see the population tripling. So I think that Cory Aquino is going to survive to the end of her term. She may even run for another term. I don't know. But I don't think she's going to be able to grapple with all these fundamental problems. Why? First of all, the problems themselves are enormous. And they do require, in my estimation, and I don't want to sound preachy about this, but they really require drastic renovation, almost a revolution. And she is quite a conservative person. She comes from a rich landowning family, and she doesn't see herself as a revolutionary. She is dedicated to what she calls democracy and stability, and rebuilding the economy. But I don't see that she's going to be able to impose completely new deal in the Philippines.
You describe your new book as history written by a journalist. Do you think that journalists write history from a different perspective than historians do? And I'm wondering even if when you studied history, when you were either in college or in high school, if there were things that didn't come to life that you've tried to bring to life as a journalist.
Journalists are historians. In a way, when you're working for a daily newspaper and you sit down at the end of the day to file your story about what happened during that day, you are, in a sense, a historian. If you work for a weekly, it's the same. The deadline's different. Macaulay, the British historian, once said that journalism is history under pressure, written under pressure. What I try to do, and I've now in this book and in earlier books, is to try to write history as if it were contemporary, as if it were happening, as if I was a reporter in 1898 reporting on Dewey sinking the Spanish fleet.
Once again, you've described the Philippines as the United States' only major colonial experience. Now, we've had relationships with other foreign countries where we have exploited the country for our own benefit. But do you think our experience in the Philippines explains why that was our only major colonial experience?
The actual acquisition of territory began in 1899 when we went to war to conquer the country from a Filipino nationalist movement that had declared independence. And it was a very bloody war. It lasted for 2.5 years. Something like 200,000 Filipinos were killed, most of them civilians. I think that when that was over, the atrocities of that war that were reported in the American press turned off Americans on territorial conquest. True, we have since tried to dominate countries politically or economically, overthrow their governments, manipulate their leaders, all the things that superpowers do in smaller countries. But the public taste for the actual acquisition of territory, I think, was very much turned off. There is an anti-colonial tradition in the United States, having been a colony ourselves. I don't think people were entirely comfortable with it during that conquest. And they weren't entirely comfortable with having a colony. It's interesting that the American officials in the Philippines, from the very start, the turn of the century, never referred to themselves as colonial officials. We never had a colonial office. We had a euphemism for it. We called it the Bureau of Insular Affairs, whatever that means.
Mm-hmm.
If you told an American that he was a colonial official in those days, he would have reacted against that. The idea of being a colonial in the British or French sense never entered the heads of Americans. They thought they were there to do good. They were almost there as secular missionaries, in a sense.
One last question. We only have about a minute remaining. In your previous series, Vietnam, a television history that was shown on public television, you used incredible footage from newscasts and, you know, other footage that journalists had gathered in Vietnam. What kind of comparable footage have you been able to find about the Philippines? And I'm talking about the earlier history before there was television. I mean, have you been able to locate gripping visual representation for the series?
Well, obviously, we couldn't have gotten film that didn't exist before the invention of the movie camera. We do have, it's interesting that with research, we found really interesting film from the early period of the century. In one case, we used movie footage that was made by Thomas Edison in New Jersey, recreating battle scenes in the Philippines. Obviously, we say it's a recreation. Then people came to us with home movies from the 1920s, 1930s, diaries of grandparents and parents who'd been school teachers or army officers, and, of course, the recollections of people. So the Philippines, it was not entirely in the television age as Vietnam was, but I think the stuff that we have on our television series on the Philippines is quite remarkable.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your research into the Philippines. Thank you. Stanley Carnell's book, In Our Image, America's Empire in the Philippines, is published by Random House. The companion TV series begins on public television May 8th. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, the plight of the world's refugees with journalist William Shawcross. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, the second half of our interview with composer Steve Reich. Today he discusses his newly recorded piece, Electric Counterpoint, commissioned for jazz guitarist Pat Metheny. It's Reich's answer to the concerto form. The composition features Metheny playing opposite his own pre-recorded tracks. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews tenor saxophonist David Murray's new album. Murray is one of the leading jazz musicians of his generation. And TV critic David Bianculli previews The Robert Guillaume Show, which debuts this week. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Michael Richards. There was more testimony at the Oliver North trial linking former President Reagan to Oliver North's activities in support of the Contras, but the testimony came, at least indirectly, from the mouth of a dead man, former CIA Director William Casey. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
On the witness stand was Vincent Canestrero, who identified himself as a former employee of a U.S. government agency. It soon became apparent the agency was the CIA. Canestrero testified that in 1984, he met with then-CIA Director William Casey and with an unidentified leader of the Contras, as well as other CIA officials. Canestrero testified that Casey told the assembled group that if the Boland Amendment passed Congress, banning military and intelligence aid to the Contras, that Oliver North had been selected to replace the CIA and to become the contact man with the Contras to aid in the Contra paramilitary operations. Judge Gazelle interrupted, "Who authorized this, Mr. Casey?" Witness Canestrero responded, "Mr. Casey said that he discussed this with the President of the United States, and that was how it was to be handled." I'm Nina Totenberg at the Federal Courthouse in Washington.
President Bush today called on Israel to withdraw from the occupied territories. Came after a meeting with Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak. The president also said he supports the idea of an international peace conference on the Middle East. Both proposals have been opposed by Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir, who arrives in Washington on Thursday. After the announcement, the president went up to Baltimore, where he threw out the first pitch of the Orioles' 1989 season. The game was against the Boston Red Sox, and Mr. Bush took along his Egyptian counterpart. Mubarak wanted especially to go because he had never seen a baseball game before. NPR's Jim Angle went with them.
Just after meeting with Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak, President Bush took his guest in tow, jumped aboard a helicopter, and headed for Orioles Stadium. President Bush, the captain of his 1948 Yale baseball team, threw out the first pitch to the cheers of the capacity crowd. It was high and outside. Joking later with reporters, Bush defended his throw, saying the catcher caught it before it started to break. Then he turned to baseball great Ted Williams and asked for an objective opinion. High, hard, and fast was Williams' appraisal. Then the president turned to baseball commissioner Abe Bartlett Giamatti for his support.
Commissioner Baseball, what did you think, sir?
Superb. I didn't see it, but I missed it.
The president sat next to Mr. Mubarak, trying to explain the game to him. The president was joined by Secretary of State Jim Baker, White House Chief of Staff John Sununu, and Budget Director Richard Darman. They returned to the White House in the middle of the fifth inning. I'm Jim Angle at the White House.
By the way, Baltimore won the game 5-4 in 11 innings. The troubled Savannah River nuclear fuel plant is under new management this week. The plant is vital to the nation's nuclear weapons arsenal. It's been shut down since last summer. Kathy Merritt of member station WFAE reports from Charlotte, North Carolina.
Westinghouse is now in charge of the Savannah River plant near Aiken, South Carolina. At a news conference today, James Moore, president of the Westinghouse Savannah River Company, said the new management wants to restart the plant's reactors safely. The three reactors at Savannah River have been shut down since last summer because of safety concerns. Cracks were found in the reactor's cooling systems. Savannah River provides the nation's only source of tritium, a perishable gas used in nuclear weapons. The Pentagon has said that unless the reactors are restarted by the end of the year, some nuclear warheads may have to be deactivated. Westinghouse officials said today they have no timetable yet for restarting the reactors. For National Public Radio, I'm Kathy Merritt in Charlotte, North Carolina.
Stock prices were higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose more than 11 points to close at 2304.8. Advances led declines 4-3 on a volume of 165 million shares. And the average price of a share on the New York Exchange gained 16 cents. This is NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Tenor saxophonist David Murray moved to New York from California in 1975, and he's been receiving mostly rave reviews ever since. He's led bands of diverse configurations, trios, quartets, octets, a big band, and a chamber jazz ensemble. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review of Murray's latest recording.
David Murray's new album, Ming's Samba, from the CBS subsidiary Portrait Records, is his first for a major American company. Still, Murray's not exactly underexposed. He's recorded well over 24 records, most for widely distributed European labels, and he's a member of the high-profile World Saxophone Quartet. It's also worth remembering that his earliest albums, dating back to 1976, came out on American independent labels, which now, as then, remain committed to adventurous jazz. Murray was a bit of a radical when he first hit the scene, but he's mellowed a lot since then. He lets out impassioned squeals on his tenor sax fairly often, but he has a big, pretty sound and swings hard, and his noisier outbursts always make sense in context. Listen to David Murray on his Brazilian-styled tune, Ming's Samba. One of the best things about David Murray's new album is that every track has a pretty melody, like the ballad Nowhere Ever After by his sometime collaborator, cornetist Butch Morris. Murray's breathy attack recalls the great tenor balladeer Ben Webster, but his pressurized falsetto sets him apart from his model. Murray plays bass clarinet on Walter's Waltz. He updates a forgotten genre known as gaspipe clarinet. That's a percussive novelty style of the 1920s. With David Murray on his new album are pianist John Hicks, bassist Ray Drummond, and drummer Ed Blackwell, three of the best current players of their respective instruments. Listen to the way they tug in three directions while still forging ahead,
on Butch Morris's tango Spooning. I love that overstated tango beat, the kind of thing you'd hear played for laughs in an old cartoon or comedy sketch. David Murray's willingness to use ostensibly corny stuff like that, or gaspipe clarinet, separates him from other so-called neo-traditionalists. Unlike them, he doesn't have a narrow view of what's worthy of revival, which is one reason he can move so naturally between polite and unruly playing. Every jazz musician draws on the past, one way or another. History teaches the smart ones that the way to make their mark is to find their own voice. David Murray has found his.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. He reviewed David Murray's new album, Ming Samba. It's on the Portrait label. This is Fresh Air. On the last Fresh Air, composer Steve Reich talked about his composition Different Trains, which was commissioned for the Kronos Quartet and is recorded on his new album. Today we listen to and talk about the other piece on this new record. It's called Electric Counterpoint, and it was commissioned by the Brooklyn Academy of Music's Next Wave Festival for jazz guitarist Pat Metheny. It's the third in a series of works Reich has written in which soloists play over pre-recorded tapes of themselves. Now, how did you come to write a piece for Pat Metheny?
Well, what happened was I had written these two earlier pieces for soloist Ransom Wilson playing flute and for Richard Stoltzman playing clarinet, where they recorded many tracks and then played against them solo. And having done this, I was approached by various classical guitar players saying, you know, gee, what you do would be great for pluck guitar sound. I said, you know, you're right. But in the back of my mind was this reserve thinking, Josh, the guitar in our time is really the electric guitar. Classical guitar is a marvelous sound. I do enjoy it, but it does seem a trifle dull. And I was having this exact conversation with Bob Hurwitz, the head of Nonesuch Records, who was formerly the head of ECM Records here in America, where both I and Pat Metheny had recorded. And he said, why don't you do something for Pat? And I said, gee, I think he'd be interested. And he said, I don't know. Why don't I call him? And he hung up the phone. And in 5 minutes, Pat and I were going over the details. So that's how it happened originally.
What interests you in the idea of a soloist playing over pre-recorded tracks of their own music?
Well, I had been approached originally by Ransom Wilson, who said, would you write me a flute concerto? And I said, I'm afraid I won't do that because I don't believe in that form. The idea of a solo instrument against the orchestra is sort of against my musical mentality. My musical mentality likes to write for multiples of the same instruments. For instruments in the orchestra pieces, for instance, there'll be three oboes doing something, and then you'll have three clarinets doing something, and then you'll have three flutes, and then you'll have them all together. Because I write interlocking counterpoint, if you like, and the idea of having similar timbres so that they form this homogeneous web is a central part of what I do. And sometimes you'll have several different instruments going on at the same time, usually do. So when Ransom wanted to do this, I knew I didn't want to do it. After I had sort of sent him packing, I thought to myself, my gosh, here's this flute virtuoso. He wants to play my music. And I called him back and said, would you be, you know, interested in doing a piece where you'd have flute and alto flute and piccolo, and you'd play against it? He said, sure, sounds great. The idea of a soloist playing against themselves also gets into a situation where you have the very essence of Pat Metheny, let's say. He's all over the place, literally. And I hope that Electric Counterpoint is obviously a piece by me, and it's heard that way. And I hope it's also obviously heard as a kind of a portrait of Pat Metheny, just as I think New York's Counterpoint was suited to Dick Stoltzman and the Vermont Counterpoint to Ransom Wilson.
Describe the instrumentation that you created for Electric Counterpoint.
Well, basically, you've got, I believe it's 10 electric guitars at a maximum playing at one time and two electric basses going on all at the same time. For instance, you'll hear at the opening, you'll hear a series of pulsing chords where basically he laid down one line at a time. And basically laying down one line at a time is what happens in the making of the tape for the piece. When the whole contrapuntal web is built up, then Pat starts playing melodic lines that come out of this contrapuntal web. You hear lots of sub-melodies. It's like looking at an oriental rug and saying, oh, gee, I like that little blue-shaped field just above that what seems like a cluster of stars there. Here he's fishing out melodies that are actually in this contrapuntal web, but that might would not necessarily come to mind as a vivid solo line. He sort of brings them up to the surface of the music.
Metheny, as an improviser, feel about playing something in which there's really no room for improvisation?
Well, of course, that was the very idea from the beginning. I mean, Pat knows my music, knows I'm a composer, and I know that he's a jazz musician. And you have a tradition for that in America, particularly Benny Goodman comes to mind, mm-hmm. who was, in his day, one of the great jazz clarinetists, and who was ended up playing Béla Bartók's Contrast, which was written with him in mind, and Aaron Copland's Concerto for Clarinet, which was written for him. And so similarly with Pat, this is a piece that's written for a jazz musician who is going to play a piece. No, he doesn't improvise at all. Why use a jazz musician if he doesn't improvise at all? Because the way he plays the piece, the feeling of the piece, you would be very hard-pressed to get, or if not impossible, to get out of a classical player. The looseness, the rhythmic flexibility, the sense of almost, I almost hear it as if he's talking a language, which we don't know what it is, but it's something that he speaks with the guitar.
You know, I've been listening to your music for a fairly long time, and I'm always just amazed at how your music changes and how those changes have a real logic to them, that your music never seems to deny what went before. It always builds on it and then find some brand new step to take a tune next. And I guess I'm wondering if those kinds of changes come naturally or if you sit down and think it is time for a next step, time for a change.
No, you were right the first time. They happen I'll tell you what actually happened. It was pretty clear. I was working on a piece called The Four Sections, which was, I would say, the last of a series of orchestra pieces that began, if you like, with variations for wind, strings, and keyboards back in 1979. So between 1979 and, let's say, 1987, I was really interested in the symphony orchestra and traditional ensembles. And when I finished The Four Sections, which I think is a very successful orchestra piece, probably the most successful piece for orchestra alone without chorus that I've done, I also felt basta, enough. I think I was reacting to the sociology of the orchestra, the fact that musicians there, let's say, don't have the kind of intense interest in what I'm doing that, let's say, my own musicians in my own ensemble have, or Kronos might have, or Pat Metheny might have, or the Ensemble Intercontemporain might have in Paris and groups like that in Europe. I think I was reacting to the fact that rehearsal time is extremely limited in the orchestra and you can't really get into the details the way I really feel you must do. And I think I was feeling enough of writing for that sociology and that world. I really have to get back to doing what it is that I did when I was younger, what it is that I feel concerns the players that are going to do this music as intensely as it concerns me as a composer.
Is there always music going through your mind, and do you ever want to try to turn it off?
No, it is not always going through my mind, and I don't usually want to turn it off, but what generally happens is that whatever I've been working on most recently sort of gets stuck there later that day and that night, and sometimes I want it to continue further than it does.
I thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Steve Reich's new album features his compositions Different Trains and Electric Counterpoint. It's on the Nonesuch label. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered and check in with co-host Noah Adams. What story is he following, Noah?
Hi, Terry. On the program tonight, a preview of the election tomorrow in Chicago. This is the to complete the term of Harold Washington, Chicago's first black mayor who died in November of 1987. We'll talk with an editorial page writer at the Chicago Tribune who explains this is not really a black and white issue in Chicago. Also, the beginning of a series of stories about black Americans with AIDS, and tonight, the difficulty that many black gays and lesbians have in being open about their homosexuality. And we'll attend a counseling session for teenage blacks at a halfway house, advice given about taking responsibility for one's sexual behavior. And Daniel Pinkwater's saga about growing up to be an artist continues.
Thanks, Noah. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The Cosby Show was one of the first sitcoms in which a black actor was cast as a professional. Television critic David Bianculli says a new sitcom, The Robert Guillaume Show, continues to widen the scope of roles for black actors on TV.
Robert Guillaume's career in TV sitcoms has been a long and steady exercise in upward mobility. In Soap, which ran from 1977 to 79, he played Benson, a sarcastic black butler who worked for a dim-witted white couple. Soap co-starred Richard Mulligan, Catherine Helmond, and Billy Crystal, but it was Guillaume who got the most attention and who was spun off into his own show. That new series didn't exactly win points for originality. It was called Benson, and it starred Guillaume as a sarcastic housekeeper who worked for a dim-witted governor. But by the time the series ended 7 years later, Benson had risen through the ranks, from household helper to state budget director, then to lieutenant governor, and finally, in the series' cliffhanger finale, to candidate for governor, running against his old employer. The show was canceled, so he never did learn who won. Starting this Wednesday, Guillaume is back in a new ABC sitcom, and signs of continued progress are all over the place. He plays a marriage counselor named Edward, but The Robert Guillaume Show has the star's name, not the name of the character he plays. The show is set in Edward's house, where he lives with his two teenage children and his father. His wife divorced him. And in the pilot episode, he interviews and hires a secretary, played by Wendy Phillips of A Year in the Life. In 10 short years, Guillaume has gone from Benson the servant to he's the boss.
Let's see now, you went to Wellesley. 3 foreign languages. A double major in sociology and Renaissance literature. I love Renaissance literature.
Renaissance literature? Yes, it's so, yes.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Wellesley is an excellent college. This is very impressive.
It's all lies.
Excuse me?
I made it up.
You didn't take Renaissance literature?
Gosh, I really wanted to.
The problem, as you may have noticed, is that the show isn't too funny. It isn't bad, but it isn't anything special either. Edward's living room looks like it was copied directly from blueprints of the Huxtable townhouse on The Cosby Show. And the only really effective scenes in the pilot are the ones between Guillaume and Hank Rollicky, who plays Edward's father.
Hey, what are you listening to? Monk. Monk who? Are you insane? There's only one Thelonious. What's the matter? You don't have any Louis Armstrong? Why would I want to listen to Louis Armstrong?
Because this man can't carry Louis spit valve.
Well, who'd want to?
One of this show's executive producers, Cy Rosen, was story editor of the old Bob Newhart show, the one where he played a psychologist. So we can expect some good scenes between Edward the marriage counselor and his clients. But the other executive producer of the Robert Guillaume show is Phil Margo, who co-wrote the Vanna White telemovie The Goddess of Love, so we can expect the worst. The most we can hope for, on balance, is that the show's sense of humor, like its star, will keep moving onward and upward. Based on the pilot, it's got a long way to go.
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, a talk with Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Galway Kinnell. We'll discuss a new unpublished poem that deals with isolation and alienation. Also, rock historian Ed Ward profiles the life and music of rhythm and blues artist William Bell. So I hope you can join us. And we'd like to welcome to Fresh Air the listeners of stations KPCC in Pasadena, California, WKNO in Memphis, Tennessee, and KASU in Jonesboro, Arkansas. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Fred Landerl. Production assistance from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton, who directed today's show. Research assistance from Christopher Cook. Our engineer is Audrey Voblaitis. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.